Services budget reform will come to order. Today is Thursday, April 10th. We are continuing with our informational meeting and invited testimony only. And first, we'd like to call up and thank you for being here from the pharmacy benefit manager for Regents, David Clark and Patty Church. Enter and sign in, please. Now, there's only one rule in this committee, and that is you have to get real friendly with these microphones when you're talking to them, which is why we have the highly sophisticated, high-tech elevating devices there. And that one microphone, Patty, will pull out of the cord, should pull. All right. Well, that's as good as that
we
one gets.
We could have had a real committee room, but no, we're here.
And if you'd like a glass of water, they're available for $200 million. Was that right?
That's correct. That's the going price for water in this committee.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for letting us come and spend a few minutes with you this afternoon. What we wanted to talk to you about is pharmacy benefit management related to the Oregon Health Plan. And the comments are basically outlined in this folder. And so if you'd like to follow along with the slides included there, we would appreciate that. The reason for us being here and the discussion points we would like to cover are that, as you know, pharmacy costs have been increasing nationally, but especially with the Oregon Health Plan. It has resulted in budget shortfalls and reduced Oregon Health Plan membership. We feel that the Oregon Health Plan is working to a certain extent with the Health Resources Commission to build pharmacy management components. These are already in the marketplace and may not need to be rebuilt. And because they are already in the marketplace, duplication of these components may actually be causing Oregon Health Plan to lose millions of dollars. If you look at the next slide, what I just wanted to outline here are several of the causes of increasing pharmacy costs. For example, we know that there are broader therapies today than there were 5 to 10 years ago. We also know that the population is aging. We've seen a lot of direct-to-physician marketing. You may not be aware that from 1995 to 2000, that the number of reps doubled in this country. And that just 2 years ago, five medications alone resulted in more than 7 million sales calls. So there's clearly a lot of direct-to-physician marketing. There's also a lot of direct-to-consumer advertising. In 1998, it was very low, but is probably over $3 billion for last year. We haven't seen the final numbers yet. Also, we know
what
that patient
over the last 5 years, David?
From 98 to 2002, for about a four to five-year period, right, that increased dramatically.
Yeah. What's that dramatic increase? What are the numbers?
Well, it went from... It was actually under 1 million in 98. There's a misprint here.
1 million or 1 billion?
Under 1 million.
Okay.
To 3 billion in 2002. I'll have to double check that number. I think I have a misprint
that can't,
on.
I don't believe in 1998 they were spending $999,999.
Right.
And in 2002, that figure had increased to $3 billion. It might have been $1 billion.
Right.
In
okay. Well, I will validate that. So it could have been $1.3 billion in 98, going up to almost about $3 billion in 2002. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Tripling that.
Right.
That I can buy.
And for the record, I didn't catch your name. You're David Clark.
I'm David Clark. Thank you.
Thank you.
Excuse me. Just not doing my job. That's what the vice chair is for, so, you know.
I'm in charge of the vice.
Slip up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Martz. Thank you.
I would point out it is a full-time job for this man to get this
Great. Also, we know that patients and physicians are frequently insulated from the actual drug costs. Therefore, they're not sure really what to do or what is most cost-effective. Turn over to the next page. A few additional components that lead to increases in pharmacy spending. We have new medications. You're aware that there are new high-cost biotech meds out there. There are also already more than 300 in pharmaceutical manufacturers' pipelines. So the biotech is not going to get simpler, it will become more of an issue. We also have seen a lot of higher cost treatments replacing low cost therapies. For example, for a patient that suffers from heartburn but not erosive esophagitis, patients now are taking proton pump inhibitors at more than $100 a month versus a generic H2 antagonist, which would be under $20 a month. We've also seen numerous patent extension products. A patent extension product is a product that the manufacturer releases so they can maintain market share, but it has very little or no clinical superiority over previously released products. For example, Glucophage was going generic. Bristol-Myers Squibb came out with Glucophage XR, which was a timed-release preparation. It is more convenient, but it's clearly much more expensive than the generic. From over about an 11-year period, approximately just over 1,000 products were released from 89 to 2000, and of those, about 65% did not offer any clinical superiority to products already on the market. For a product to be allowed to get on the market, they have to prove to the FDA that they are safe and they are more effective than placebo. They don't have to prove they are more effective than products already available. Now, great. As far as
I'm making a face at Ralph Groener, who's disrupting the committee as usual. It's okay, David. That's not your fault. It's Ralph Groener's fault.
Hi, Ralph.
Hi, Ralph. Hi.
You can leave now, Ralph.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As far as Regents and the Regents Group and Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon, we've been very much involved with managing pharmacy costs. We understand the cost drivers. We have extensive clinical expertise on our team, and we have successfully managed pharmacy benefits for more than 20 years. Currently, we have more than 2.2 million lives on our pharmacy benefits, and with our program, we have received national recognition from the Best of Blues, Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, the International Society for Pharmacoeconomic Outcomes Research, also Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, and from the National Managed Healthcare Congress. And we have proven results. Now, with our experience, what I'd like to have you look at is the next slide. And what we've listed on the next few slides are some of the components that we feel need to be in a successful pharmacy benefit or pharmacy cost management program. And what we've also indicated is, based on our understanding, whether or not the program that's currently used by the Oregon Health Plan includes those components or not. The first one of those is rigorous review of scientific data. We know that the Health Resources Commission has been working aggressively to come up with a review. Over the past multiple months, almost 2 years, they've been able to review 5 therapeutic classes out of the many classes that are out there. Now, we very much support that rigorous review. The process that they're using was first initiated by Regents in 1998, later adopted by the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, and was the model again used for the Health Resources Commission. We support a very active clinical scientific-based review. One of our concerns there, though, is the process as it was originally written requires pharmaceutical companies to release to us for review unpublished studies. These are studies they may not want in the public domain, and as such, with the Health Resources Commission process, have not been available to those subcommittees. And so we are able to get those. We know that there is some pharmacoeconomic evaluation that occurs with the subcommittees and the Health Resources Commission. We applaud that. Clearly, it's the right step to take. It's something we do as well. One of our concerns, though, is that with the current process, there is little or slow review of new scientific data. We monitor studies coming out all the time. We monitor the major publications as well as the major conferences held by societies worldwide to see what the new data is, so we can determine really which products are the most cost-effective. And currently with the process used, we have not seen a demonstration of a rigorous monitoring of new data coming out once a decision is made in a therapeutic category.
Mr. Chair.
Representative March.
David, you're reviewing unpublished studies, and one of the, of course, values of published studies is they've gone through a rigorous peer review process. in what kind of weight do you give unpublished studies?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative March, thank you for the question. Clearly, the studies we lean the most on are those that have been peer-reviewed. What the unpublished studies give us, though, is more evidence as to where the products might really be effective. For example, if we've been reviewing a published study and we find out that the dosage ranges used were A, B, and C, we then go back to the manufacturer. Why did you use these? What studies helped you come up with these? And we can frequently determine that perhaps a dose higher than C has no clinical value, even though it may start to be used in the community. By understanding that, then we can work with the physicians that are treating our members, our patients, to help them understand what the clinical evidence really is. So it helps us that way. It also helps us understand other areas that they may not be effective. If the FDA has approved a medication to be used in three or four different conditions, frequently the medical community may try it in additional. It's possible it's been studied in those, was found to be ineffective, but that data has not been released.
So like the off-label.
Right. Yeah. So it does help us monitor that and does also help us as we establish criteria for the approved use of those medications.
Thank you.
Another thing that we try and do aggressively is we monitor the manufacturer pipelines. The pharmaceutical manufacturers are very supportive of healthcare in this country. They put a lot into research and development, but because of that, there are thousands of medications in those pipelines that could be released in the next few years. We monitor products that are in final stages of phase two, phase three, and then phase four is when they've entered the market. So we monitor those so we have an idea of what's going to be coming out and what value it might have. So if it's being released and has little value, then we can actually put some steps into the process to decrease its use at the beginning instead of waiting until it's gained a foothold through marketing. And we found that to be very valuable and very effective. Other key strategies?
David, if I could... just to interrupt, I'm assuming the pharmaceutical companies welcome that.
Mr. Chair, yes, the pharmaceutical companies do to an extent, especially if the product has clinical superiority. If it proves based on the clinical review that it's a me-too product or does not have a clear advantage, they do not welcome it. And so occasionally we do have companies that do not want to give us their data prior to launch.
So a little...
There's some push.
Six and pull. One half dozen of another mixed bag.
Very much.
Okay.
But as mentioned, we do review products pre-launch, and we also make sure that within 30 days of launch, based on all available evidence, that we have also done another review of products to make sure we haven't missed anything. And then clearly, once all products have been out and comprehensive data is available, we make sure, again, that they've been re-reviewed. So this is what we have seen as very effective is a very active review process. You don't review a class of medications and then let it sit and wait years before you review it again. Also, based on that, we make sure that we have done at least a review of all therapeutic classes every year so that we haven't missed anything. Mr. Chairman, along with your comment earlier about the pharmaceutical company sharing data, because they do know we do these subsequent reviews, they're very good to make sure we get the latest and greatest information. So we do have that. Additional key strategies in the next slide. What we found is that reviews need to be efficient and time-sensitive. If a review takes more than several weeks to a month or two, by then there's been significant marketing, and it's hard to decrease inappropriate utilization. But then, like what the Health Resources Commission and the Oregon Health Plan have been trying to do, we do promote use where superiority has been established, and we do discourage other uses. One other key strategy that we feel needs to be included, which we do not believe is currently included, is that when contracting with pharmaceutical manufacturers, that contracting needs to be completed prior to release of the decision of which products are preferred. Once we've stated publicly that we prefer product A, there's little incentive for that manufacturer to give the discounts to help lower the cost to an appropriate level. So it's been our experience that a very key strategy to getting the lowest appropriate cost is to make sure that during the review process that negotiations are ongoing and that we do not wait until we have said, yes, drug A is the best. Once we've said that, the manufacturer can easily say, you've said it the best. You need to use it no matter what price we charge.
That's kind of like how Bates buys cars.
You heard about that.
You walk into a Chevy dealership with a Ford outfit right across the street and says, I only buy Chevys. You know, that's how I notice. You think I'm kidding? I'm not kidding. I notice out of these 12 strategies,
yes,
that the state's ripping along with right at three of them.
From our perspective. Yes, Mr. Chair.
That's helpful to know.
Yeah.
Put it graphically.
But clearly, if you are working on the clinical reviews and you have started your negotiations with the manufacturers, it gives you the most clout and the most leverage. And it also does help significantly with the pharmacoeconomics review, because if you don't know what your final cost is going to be, it's hard to do that review. As you consider these strategies, though, what we've seen through the Regents Group, as we've used this program, and again, the clinical-based scientific program that we do for review of products, again, it was the model used by the Academy of Managed Care Pharmacy, which was then also modeled, the Health Resources Commission used to model the program that's currently in place. But what we do is we, besides doing the reviews, we do develop and write complete drug monographs. We also publish summaries that are easy for physicians to review quickly. We found that when we have a 20-page monograph, that most physicians don't have the time to review those in detail and understand them, so we normally publish a 2-page review with references so they understand the highlights. If they have further questions, they can then refer to the drug monographs. One concern that we do have is the summaries or reviews published by the Health Resources Commission are lengthy, and sometimes you have to read them 2 or 3 times to understand the conclusions, and that is not going to be very effective in encouraging physicians to prescribe in the most cost-effective manner. Based on what we've been doing, we have been successful. One of the things that we were very pleased with is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan was monitoring our program, saw our success, and last year asked us to start to help them as well. So they are now using our clinical reviews. We're publishing them, giving them to them, and we're also doing their manufacturer contracting for them to help increase their savings, help them focus on lowest net cost, and save millions for their membership as well. On the next slide, it highlights a few more things that the Regents Group has worked on. We do promote appropriate generic utilization. Generics have been out a long time. We know how effective they are. We know how safe they are. The biggest problem is they aren't marketed anymore. And so sometimes their use gets diminished. To do this, we have worked on a lot of physician and patient education. We do provide those to groups and to members and, again, to doctors. We also have a sampling program where we have enabled physicians to give generic products at no cost to members to get them started on medications. The reason we did that is we identified, as have others, that one of the major reasons for starting patients on a brand name medication is that there are samples in the physician's office. The physician says, try this. If it works, here's a prescription. The physician may not be aware that prescription runs $60, $80, $100, when a generic that would be just as effective clinically may only run $20. I mentioned that we do contract directly with manufacturers. The one thing that we're pleased with is when we brought the contracting in-house to the Regents Group is that we stated up front to the manufacturers that unlike many of the for-profit pharmacy benefit management companies, we would not accept access fees, admin fees, or marketing fees from pharmaceutical companies, because we've noticed that not only could those help increase inappropriate utilization, but they also lower the discounts available to the group paying for the medications.
What percent do those normally run? What type of?
They do run about 25% of the total dollars available from the manufacturer.
Of, quote, savings, rebates,
Yeah, about 25% of the discounts are rebates. A couple of the for-profit PBMs have published or stated in meetings that they do normally accept up to 3%. Some go to 3.5%. And there was a statement by one of the CEOs of a PBM last year that even though they did that, it did not equate to more than 1% of total drug cost. 1% of total drug cost, so it's still a lot of money. And that was total drug cost, including generics and non-contracted brands.
That question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the reason that Regents can do this effectively is contracting directly with their manufacturers is because of your size? Because I'm thinking for a lot of groups, they're in a situation where there's no way that they could compete and bring enough market share to get a price that would be better than what they can get through a PBM.
Mr. Chair, Representative Merkley, that's an excellent question. There's two major factors that drive discounts from pharmaceutical manufacturers. The first and most important is the level of penetration you have within a market. And after that, then comes the size or volume. Fortunately for the Regents Group, we have very good penetration in the four states that we are in. Plus, we also have a large enough size so that the two together help us get very good discounts from manufacturers.
So, Mr. Chair, then this is the part of why bulk purchasing is a feasible strategy for the state of Oregon.
Except they don't have access, really, I don't think, to Medicaid drugs. We do. We get the latest, lowest transacted price. And as we look at this, I mean, nothing's okay. Simple.
Yeah.
But just as a follow-up to one of your questions, by the way, this is Representative Jeff Merkley. He's the guy most responsible for bringing Desmond Tutu to the state of Oregon last night. And I don't know how many of you were able to see that, but thank you for your efforts.
You're welcome.
What are the number of your covered lives?
Again, we cover 2.2 million plus another 800,000 from Michigan, so 3 million lives.
Yeah, just like me, a little bit short of the entire state of Oregon.
Okay, Chair.
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What's your usual discount or rebates compared to AWP?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates.
And generic.
Yeah. Well, first of all, on generics, we do not get additional rebates.
Right.
We focus on the lowest cost there, and we actually manage a maximum allowable cost price list so that pharmacies can't go on the spread. We know what they buy it for, and our reimbursement to pharmacies on generics is based on that. On brands, it will vary. Discounts can range anywhere from 5 to 7% up to about 40, depending on the product. Across our total book of business, the averages, including generics and non-covered brands, is about 4 to 4.5%.
Mr. Chair, follow up?
Representative Bates.
A couple more questions, if I could. So you're about 5 to 7% of AWP. Do you run any Medicaid programs?
Currently, we are not involved with any Medicaid programs.
Okay.
Another thing, if I could, I'd like to make a couple more comments about the contracting on brands. And basically what that is, traditionally for a month's supply, a generic runs about $17 to $18. A brand averages about $80. There would have to be discounts exceeding 75% for a brand to get that's equally effective to a generic to get to a generic level. What we do focus on is primarily generic utilization, but we've been very effective on the brand name contracting as well. A major issue would be to work toward generic utilization, and that was covered on a later slide. We were pleased that when we used to work with the Oregon Health Plan, that our generic utilization exceeded 60%.
Mr. Chair, follow up. I understand that concept, and quite frankly, our managed care plans are probably at 70, 75% right now or higher, so that concept is being followed. But I'm most concerned about the brand name discount you're receiving. In order to get that discount, you have to hit a certain market share or a certain number of prescriptions, or do you have a formulary you use or preferred drug list you use to get those discounts?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bates, we do have a preferred drug list or formulary that we do use. We do recommend to physicians which products to prescribe that are most cost-effective in various therapeutic categories. clearly they are the ones doing the prescribing, that we share with them the results of our clinical or scientific-based review so that they understand which products will drive the same clinical outcome for a lower net cost.
Well, Mr. Chair. And let's take a class of drugs like the SSIs. Other than Prozac, which is generic, would you have would the physician be looking at a choice of drugs there, or a single drug that was preferred first and could be attempted to be used first after Prozac, or do you have it kind of wide open?
Yeah.
David, could you ask him not to do this doctor speak thing and identify what SSI is for the benefit of Lori Monas Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, for the rest of the committee, I believe you're referring to SSRIs, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors known as antidepressants. So patients that are depressed...
Sorry, I slipped.
So these are for patients who are depressed.
I am depressed.
And currently, as mentioned, fluoxetine, which is the generic name for Prozac, is readily available at a very, very low cost. We do have additional SSRIs available on our preferred drug list. We have not put all SSRIs on there, but it's fairly broad, so that we give physicians flexibility while still helping them understand which ones have the lowest cost.
Last question.
Thank you.
On the brand names of those antidepressants, how do you make the selection from one to the other of which ones are on the formulary or which ones are off? It's very difficult for all of us. Is it a price-based or is it...
Mr. Chair, Representative Bates, this is one of the challenges in the current market because very rarely do the pharmaceutical companies do head-to-head comparative studies. So that is a major challenge. What we do look at, though, are the results of the studies that have been done more recently, especially in broad categories like the SSRIs. More head-to-head studies are being completed, and we do use those results. Clearly, if a product has been shown to be effective and it's not overly costly, because we do look at the value of the medication, if the product costs twice as much but all the studies don't show any benefit, we do discourage its use. However, if a physician has tried the others and they're not effective, then we do allow the use at that point in time.
Thank you.
Great.
Representative Monas Anderson.
I want to get off the formulary a bit for just 60 minutes. I want to go back to the slide where you were the key strategies to restrain costs and promote quality. And you're saying, you know, there's rigorous review of scientific data that I assume that's Blue Cross Blue Shield staff.
Yes.
And then pharmacoeconomic evaluations, and then review. And then who's paying for this? Isaac, obviously it comes through premiums. But the one little question I have, manufacturer or the supporting Blue Cross Blue Shield Michigan, do they pay Oregon Blue Cross Blue Shield for the services that you're doing? Those were the types of questions I
had. Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the question, if I understand correctly, is who pays for doing all this review? Basically, the reviews are funded by the Regents Group, because it's a necessary component to effectively manage the pharmacy costs for our customers. So we fund it. We do not accept funds from manufacturers to do that. For the addition of the Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan lives, they do provide us with a fee for providing that same service for them, so they don't have to duplicate the service and redo all the reviews that we've already done.
And a follow-up? And is this a significant piece of your budget, or is it a small percentage?
Our largest percentage of our budget is actually doing customer service work, helping members and pharmacies understand how to get the most out of the benefit. We man our own pharmacy help desk, and so that takes a lot of personnel to answer the phones. So that's our biggest piece. After that, our clinical review would be the second largest for pharmacy. Yes, thank you.
Please continue.
Thank you. Where we left off, I believe, was where we're talking about rebate yields. And I did want to state that when we moved away from using PBM contracts with manufacturers, our rebates did increase by more than 25%. And that what we've also been doing is working with pharmaceutical companies on appropriate messaging. Because we have significant penetration in our areas, besides telling them these are the products we prefer, we also ask them, we also work with them on what messages we feel are appropriate to share so we can decrease inappropriate utilization or off-label use. So we have some clout there too. A few other things that we do is that we do manage our own pharmacy network. And we do have our contracts encourage pharmacies to support appropriate generic utilization. And again, we do focus on clinical appropriateness. One of the things that we pride ourselves on is that by doing the work right for managing pharmacy benefits, it helps lower our cost. If we didn't do it right, it would raise our costs, whereas some of the for-profit PBMs, because approximately half their revenue comes from the pharmaceutical manufacturer industry, by not doing it right, they might actually make more money. So we are at risk just like our customers are. A few of our results, our trend from 2001 to 2002 was approximately 11%, which was below national averages. And as you know, we currently work with PEB. Our total increase for 2003-2004 will be at roughly 9.9 or 10%. So we've been able to effectively do that. And a lot of that's tied in with the discounts we get currently from manufacturers as well as our focus on net cost. Previously, we did work with Oregon Health Plan. In the first years, we worked with them from, I believe, 87 through 2001. The first few years, we were able to actually keep the trend at approximately zero. Over time, though, the trend did start to go up. The last 3 years are listed here. And even though the 20%, for example, in 2000 was higher than we would have liked, it was still well below what other Medicaid groups were seeing nationally. Just in summary, we would
How did that compare to the rest of your population?
Mr. Chair, it was actually about the same or a little bit lower than the rest of our population. We were managing a closed benefit for the OHP members.
And so these trends grew at lower than your commercial population?
At that time, yes.
Huh. Okay.
What we would like to recommend is that the Oregon Health Plan program does include a fully developed program with all the components, including continuing clinical and scientific reviews, but on a more timely basis. And perhaps they could consider using some of the companies that are doing it already commercially instead of trying to reinvent the process. Also, as they're doing that, it should be timely and effective. And hopefully that whoever's doing, if someone is selected externally, they will have proven experience and that they will also have proven effectiveness in managing costs and promoting generic utilization. Thank you.
Flesh out, I mean, you just kind of took me back to say you manage your own pharmacy network. Give me a 50,000-foot level of how that thing works.
Managing our own pharmacy network is that we contract with retail pharmacies, both independent and chains, setting both the AWP discounts on brands. We do our own maximum allowable cost pricing on generics. We also set the fee that they can charge for filling a prescription, and then we do that also with mail order.
Follow up on that?
Okay, so you have utilization, you know, throughout the entire state, I'm assuming every
yes.
pharmacy.
Yes, we have approximately, Mr. Chair, we have approximately 90% of the pharmacies in the state in our network. We do actually manage a national network because many of our employer groups have employees across the country, and we have approximately 43,000 pharmacies in that network.
Yeah, quickly.
That was my question.
Very good. Well, look, you guys, you know, you manage our health care, so just keep doing what you're doing. Patty, what do you got for us?
I was here as a technical resource, and so I think this concludes our presentation unless you have any other specific questions for us.
Well, we can ask some really hard questions, but, you know, you look like a nice, much nicer person than David, so.
She is.
Well, the only comment I guess I make on your presentation, which I appreciate very much, is just on the increases in pharmacy spending, That's a very sophisticated area, and I don't think you touched on incident use and some of the R&D and keeping drugs in the pipeline, and that 2 out of 10 that actually make it to the market are profitable, and how many don't make it to the market. I mean, this is an expensive business, and you know the fundamental question. You don't have to answer this. In fact, don't. But it's, you know, I mean, do the pharmaceuticals that are available for us today, you know, have they improved the quality of life and lowered overall healthcare costs while they've extended quality of life? I mean, how do you answer that question? Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I would like to state that we do support appropriate R&D, and that it's our belief that of the new medications coming out, that at least approximately 35% do improve the quality of health, do help reduce side effects or provide other benefit to the users. The challenge is not paying more for those other 65% than we could pay for lower cost alternatives.
Well, we know when, now Linda, you quit laughing over there. We know when Coke and Pepsi comes out with a new product, it's probably not extending the quality of life, or the length of life, but that's a whole different story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative March had a question.
Hey, this is out of curiosity, and I imagine you were too. When the state's lists have come out, I imagine you sort of eyeballed yours and theirs, and how'd ours look?
What state list?
Well,
we've got a preferred drug list. We don't have a formulary.
No, I didn't say formulary. I said list.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Representative March, as far as preferred medications, preferred drugs, we have a lot of similarities. For example, in the 5 categories that have been completed by the Health Resources Commission, we only took exception with 1 of the 5. So there are some similarities. The outcomes are similar. One of the challenges in the statins is the category where we have differences, and it's a definition of what is evidence-based medicine. And is it proving that there are outcomes reduced, or is it proving that they actually deliver benefit better than others? And that's one of the challenges that the current process has, because since that was published last week, there was a new study published that showed that a major product that costs less than the 2 branded focus products on the list actually does improve clinical outcomes. So,
thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. One question for Patty. You can't get out of here without having a question. You can't see this, but behind every microphone is an apple.
Except
mine.
What does that mean?
Mr. Chairman, as long as they're not tossed our way, it just means you'll have a healthy snack this afternoon.
Yeah, I got to read more into it than that. These are courtesy of our very august staff, Kelly over here, who takes care of us. Thank you very, very much. Blood sugar late in the afternoon, complicated subject. We nibble up here. Trying to stay attentive. Thank you.
Yes.
Next to the dais
here. Are you trying to compare apples and oranges?
No, I was making the observation that is a distinction with a difference. Not a distinction without a difference, as we learned in the 4th special session. From the Pharmacy Benefit Administration, and going to speak to us on the multi-state purchasing pool, Scott Alaco.
Very good, thank you.
From First Health. Enter and sign in, please. Again, get real friendly with one of those microphones.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for inviting me out today. I'm the Vice President of Government Relations for First Health Services. Representative Bates, good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
First Health Services is a pharmacy benefits administrator. Unlike a PBM, we do not have any contracts or revenue with the pharmaceutical manufacturers. We also, in the administration of our pharmacy programs, by definition, all rebates are returned to the state. In fact, all of the checks from the pharmaceutical manufacturers are made out to the state of Oregon and deposited in their accounts by state of Oregon employees. I appreciate the challenges you are confronting as the former Director of Government Affairs for the New Jersey Department of Health. I know how difficult these budget issues can be. My goal today is to explain some of the complicated Medicaid rules that apply to Medicaid programs that do not apply to the programs that were just described. And I was planning to spend some time talking about supplemental rebates and the multi-state pooling program that our company developed. Before I do that, I just wanted to summarize what's in your packets. We have a newsletter describing some key issues related to the development of preferred drug lists. The second sheet on the left-hand side describes the maximum allowable cost program that we have implemented for the state of Oregon. We apply many of the tools of the pharmacy benefit management industry. We apply for state governments. This MAC list program has helped address the issue of generic drug utilization and generic drug compensation to make sure that the state of Oregon is paying a fair price for generic drugs in the Oregon Health Plan. On the right-hand side are several newsletters describing some key issues for states. The first is a summary of the recent federal court decision that upheld CMS's right and the state's rights to develop prior authorization-based preferred drug lists and supplemental rebate programs. The second describes our multi-state pooling program with the states of South Carolina, Michigan, and Vermont. The third emphasizes how the Bush administration and CMS in Washington are encouraging all states to implement preferred drug list and supplemental rebate programs, given their dramatic cost savings around the country. And then finally, this newsletter describes the support of the National Governors Association for these programs that, in fact, declared preferred drug list to be the state's most effective tool in controlling drug costs. I was going to focus most of my remarks today on this black and white printout that is in the middle of your packet. The first slide describes a very important issue, given all of your discussions about whether or not the drug spend should or should not be carved out from the MCO managed care contracts or not. The key issue is that in a Medicaid managed care plan, the Medicaid best price rule does not apply. So the maximum rebates that any Medicaid managed care plan can get in the United States is approximately 6 or 7%, which is in fact the rebate that most MCOs get here in Oregon. The MCO's contract
with... flesh that out again, because sure. Merkley was talking in my ear when, you know, he should have been listening.
Sure.
Just, you know, the point about Medicaid...
The best price rule?
Yeah.
Sure. This document summarizes the average rebates that the Medicaid managed care plans get versus the rebates that the state of Oregon gets through the fee-for-service program. The generic manufacturers do not pay any rebate to a Medicaid managed care plan. They pay approximately a 6 to 7% rebate to a Medicaid MCO. The Medicaid MCOs typically contract with commercial PBMs like Express Scripts, Advanced PCS, Merck Medco, and it's not clear whether or not that rebate money goes back, stays with the PBM, or goes back to the MCO. The one thing we do know is that it does not go back to the state of Oregon. The Medicaid fee-for-service programs, the Medicaid best price rule applies only to them, so that when a Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service client goes to the pharmacy and submits a prescription, the state of Oregon then bills the generic drug manufacturer 11% or $11 per every $100 worth of drug, or at least 15%, but most likely 20% if it is a brand name drug. And if you were to do a supplemental rebate program, your percentage is most likely to be higher than that. The state of California has had a supplemental rebate program in place for some time. So their average rebate collection rate is 24.5%. So for every $100 million of drug spend, the pharmaceutical manufacturers would pay the MCOs $6 million if the drugs are administered through the MCO, or $20 million to the state of Oregon.
Chair, so that's a gross number.
It's gross number. It's a rough estimate.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
On the rebate that you get on a Medicaid fee for service, is it not true that 60% of that rebate goes back to the federal government and 40% comes to the state?
That is correct. That is also true of the MCO plans. Any of the costs for the capitated payments are paid 40% by the state and 60% by the federal government.
So the Medicaid fee for service, the real discount is to the state, is about 8%, if it's 20% average.
No, actually, you need to compare it apples to apples, and that would be that...
We're actually using apples to oranges.
If you're paying a Medicaid MCO $100 per member per month, an estimate of $15 per member per month is dedicated to pharmacy. That includes in Oregon an acknowledgement of the 6% rebate that those MCOs are getting. So if you were to carve out the drug spend from the MCO contracts, taking away their responsibility for providing a drug benefit, you would want to reduce their capitation rate by approximately $15. Now, all of these expenses on both sides of the ledger are 40% state and 60% federal.
So that's why you're asking if this was a gross number. So 60% of this fee-for-service has to go back to the feds.
That's correct. And out of that $15 per member per month that you're paying to the MCOs, you're paying 40% of that $15, and the feds are paying 60% of it.
So my point is, the real discount to the state is not the 24%, it's 40% of that.
The real discount to the state, if your compensation to the pharmacist was the same, they both paid the same AWP minus 15%, 16%, the same dispensing fees, then that element of the equation is equal. So the differential would be these rebate numbers, which would be the difference between 6% and 20%, or 14%. Per every $100 million. The net difference...
60% you have to pay back to the Fed.
That's correct.
On both of them.
The net difference is 14%, of which for every $100 million, 40% of that is state and 60% is federal.
So, to say this a different way, real rough math, if we got to give 60% back on the 11, you know, we're keeping, I'm guessing, 4%. And if take an average figure, well, you know, say it's 25 or 20% on the brand, you know, we've got to give back 14 or so. It's within a percent or two. I'm an orange kind of guy, so I got to...
Perhaps if we flip...
I mean, we're just looking at net numbers. I mean, this is... We're not arguing. We're just trying to clarify, I think.
Well, one key issue is that if you were to carve out the drug spend from the managed care contracts, if you were to carve out $200 million worth of drug spend that you're currently paying that $15 per member per month, that currently those MCOs are only getting a 6% rebate on that. Whereas if you were to shift that $200 million drug spend to the other side of the ledger, in the fee-for-service environment, you would generate at least 20%, a 20% rebate. In that scenario.
No, so, we disagree with that. Or I do, anyway.
But the state gets...
Yeah.
We're worried about the state. We're not worried about the feds too much here.
Yeah, the important thing here is net to the state. It's not net rebate. We don't care.
Well,
we care about adding populations, providing more services, adding benefits, and adding populations. If we send in 60% to the feds, we don't. That money is, I don't want to say it's meaningless to us, but it's not. We can't utilize it.
Well, I do appreciate the difference in the state share and the importance from your perspective of having to come up with the state money to fund these programs. I do think that is just something that you need to look at very closely, because some states, like the state of Tennessee, have tried to maintain different preferred drug lists for different managed care organizations and have them somehow try to collect these higher federal rebates, which has been very problematic. In fact, I think I've included a summary of the state of Tennessee's plan to establish one preferred drug list for the entire 10-care program as a means of simplifying life for the doctors that are currently juggling 14, 15 different preferred drug lists, and the Tennessee's goal of trying to maximize their supplemental rebates. If we could turn to page 2, this is a sample therapeutic class.
Well, Scott, I don't want to belabor this or belittle it, but when I see charts like this, and you're talking about these larger numbers of rebates, supplemental rebates, I mean, that's fine. It's accurate, but for our purposes, I think it distorts the reality, because we're not getting those kind of rebates. We're not entitled to them. I'm not saying we should be, but people look at these that don't kind of live in this world and they go, oh, my God, we can get back 25%. Well, we don't get back 25%.
Well, Representative, actually, one of the issues that I wanted to address this morning is the issue of the provision in your recommended, the March 24th version of the committee's recommendations. One of the recommendations is to audit First Health Services. Well, the important point to recognize is that as the administrator for the Oregon Health Plan, an audit of First Health Services would be an audit of the state of Oregon, because these rebates that I'm referring to, this 20% number, is actually the rebates when a pharmacy claim is paid over our system for the Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service program. That prescription for Schering Plough's Claritin generates a rebate bill, invoice, that we send to Schering Plough, that Schering Plough then cuts a check for the rebate owed to the state, which is then sent back to the state of Oregon for deposit in the Oregon financial accounts. So the 20% rebate number is a very realistic one. And that is, in fact, approximately the average rebate for the past 2 or 3 years that the Oregon Health Plan has been generating on the fee-for-service side. The problem with the management of the fee-for-service side is that OMAP and First Health have not been given the authority to use the same management tools that are currently being used in the managed care populations. The development of a comprehensive preferred drug list with an aggressive prior authorization program, all of those tools that the commercial PBMs are using to manage their care are not allowed to be used aggressively by First Health Services and OMAP for the fee-for-service program. So when the managed care organizations say that they can manage the care better in the managed care plans, you just need to keep in mind that that OMAP and First Health could do the exact same programs if we were given the authority and permission to do so. And that is the MAC list that I just described is one initiative that we've already done. We've done a comprehensive claims analysis of the Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service program and have estimated that the savings to the state just for the more aggressive management of the fee-for-service program would be between $25 and $30 million per year if Oregon were to authorize us to develop a comprehensive preferred drug list and negotiate supplemental rebates with the pharmaceutical manufacturers. And the key is, on the second graph, that prior to your evidence-based management initiative, the Oregon Health Plan fee-for-service program was one of the only open formulary programs left in the United States, where these more expensive drugs that are heavily advertised by direct-to-consumer advertising, the Oregon Health Plan members can just walk in and request these medications with almost no controls whatsoever. Whereas in a managed care plan in the Oregon Health Plan, this drug and drug number A and drug number C may not even be available under any circumstances because they are allowed to have closed formularies. At least on the fee-for-service side of the ledger, CMS requires that all drugs in the therapeutic class must be made available, but they allow the prior authorization process to take place, whereas a physician could, in some circumstances, justify that these more expensive drugs, A and C, might be medically necessary. So the key to realizing savings here is to shift patients from these more expensive drugs to the less expensive drugs. You can imagine if you had 50,000 patients per month taking the $70 drug, shifting those 50,000 people to the $27 drug, how many more people could you cover under the Oregon Health Plan? So what we then have done is to negotiate supplemental rebates with the pharmaceutical manufacturers. Again, using a free market technique, these were initially developed by the Republican administrations of Governor Jeb Bush and Governor John Engler in Michigan. And as I mentioned, they are strongly supported by the Bush administration in Washington because they apply free market tools to let the pharmaceutical manufacturers bid against each other for the opportunity to be on the preferred drug list. The prior speaker mentioned the role of cost effectiveness and the need to include cost in the final determination about what drugs should or should not be preferred in a preferred drug list. I've also included some statements from the president of Merck, who has made similar comments about the need to, for states to recognize value and the need for pharmaceutical manufacturers to provide a competitive price in this whole equation. So this is the reference-based model that we use for the state of Michigan. First Health has now developed 4 preferred drug lists for the states of Michigan, South Carolina, Vermont, and Ohio. The general goal is to get the pharmaceutical manufacturers to compete against each other and lower their price. In this particular model, supplemental rebates, this is above and beyond the 15 to 20% rebate that has already been paid to the state. This is a supplemental rebate negotiation that brings brings prices lower by convincing the pharmaceutical manufacturers to reduce their price in this instance by $29, drug B by $11. Drug C has decided not to provide a supplemental rebate. They are thus subject to prior authorization. Drug D only has to provide a $1 supplemental rebate to bring its net cost down to the price of drug G, which was determined to be the preferred drug in this particular model. This next page then shows you how, in this particular instance, all of the drugs cost the same. The lowest net cost to the state is $27. So it doesn't matter to the state which one of these drugs is prescribed, as long as it's not the one that costs $70, which requires a prior authorization and medical justification to get it. Again, just to summarize the savings, we've estimated based on the Michigan and Vermont and Ohio preferred drug list experience that the savings that states can expect are between 8 and 13%, which gets us that $25 to $30 million per year number. Keep in mind that those savings come in two different ways. one from the supplemental rebates that are negotiated, but that is a small portion of the actual savings. The real savings is through compliance with the preferred drug list. And that is one of the current problems with the current Oregon evidence-based model, is that because the physicians are not required to request a prior authorization, they don't comply with the preferred drug list nearly as much as they would in a state that had a more aggressive prior authorization requirement in place. In fact, I believe the current compliance rate for those limited drug classes that you have in place is about 40 to 50%, whereas in Michigan, where there's a mandatory prior authorization requirement, the compliance by physicians is roughly 90%. So again, you can see that most of the savings is shifting drug share from drug C. Maybe it's a Pfizer manufacturer, loses market share, but Schering Plough increases its market share dramatically. So even though the state has just established a very significant savings, Schering Plough has benefited by gaining its market share, whereas Pfizer has lost under this model because they've lost market share for their more expensive product. So,
Representative Bates.
I'm slow you down for a second. Ask
that summarizes you, that my presentation.
Okay. Let me ask a few questions because some of your testimony is quite interesting. What percent in Michigan and Ohio, as an example, especially Michigan, which has been in place probably longer? Do you know what percentage of that market there is generic now? When you move people, obviously you move to market.
Actually,
mark
this generic. Is this was the last slide that I should have mentioned. This is the generic drug utilization shift in a before and after analysis of the Michigan Preferred Drug List initiative. Prior to the institution of the PDL model in Michigan, the generic utilization was 47%. After the institution of the plan, the generic utilization increased by 4% to 51%. There are also numerous other programs that we would recommend the state implement to increase generic drug utilization. I believe OMAP is implementing several of them already. There are a whole variety of other services that we could institute, clinical detailing of physicians that are writing an abnormally high percentage of brand name drugs rather than generic. Drug regimen review of high drug utilizing patients that are taking 12 or more drugs per month, and then also case management of high drug utilizing patients.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Yeah, we're all pretty familiar with that stuff by this point after beating ourselves over for 2 or 3 months. In your generic market, with your supplemental savings, are the cost of the brand names with your supplemental savings getting pretty close to the generic cost, or is there still a significant difference between generics and brand names with the supplemental discounts?
Well, the one issue that's really has been debated is the 6-month exclusivity period when a brand name drug goes to generic. There's some question about whether or not, in some circumstances, there are some brand name drugs after rebates that are less expensive than the new drug that has just gone to generic that's only paying the 11% rate. And that may occur in some limited instances, but in general, the generic drugs are still significantly cheaper than the brand name drugs, even after the rebates.
Going back to Mr. Chair. Come back to the example. I like using examples, and I appreciate using the example of Claritin. I want to tell you, too, that you're offering a model here for the best of both worlds to a certain degree. You get the discount, and you get the management. But on the Claritin example, you said that it's common that in Claritin that about 20% of the drug cost is being deposited right back into as a rebate directly into the accounts of the state of Oregon.
Yes.
Does Oregon then have to split any of that back out to the federal government?
That's correct. All of the Medicaid expenses, whether it's through the managed care plans or the fee for service plan, are 60% of them are paid for by the state, and then any revenues are shared in the same percentage.
So the 20% that comes back to the state, does the state then cut a check back to the federal government?
That's correct. Okay. That's absolutely correct.
Okay. Wait. Say that again.
The rebate dollars from the pharmaceutical manufacturers The money comes in, state deposits the check, and then they fill out what's called a CMS 64 report to the federal government, and then they pay back the amount of money that's owed the federal government, the $60 per hundred, 60% per hundred.
Okay.
Yep, that's one miniature.
You went 60 and then 20 and 20, and I'm going, wait, I'm missing.
60 and 40 is what he meant, I think. The 20, he gets a 20% discount, but it's deposited direct to the state and it goes up. I'll ask one last question. I hope you'll take this in the right vein. The process of getting that list of what the state bought to whoever makes Claritin, which just slips my mind. Is it? I can't remember which company is offhand. Anyway, so you send them
the invoice
saying this is the amount of product that was sold this
yes.
month or this quarter or whatever, and then they cut the check based off that. This is the issue of an audit. I mean, it seems like to me this is a very complex situation, and to make a mistake in there would not be out of the realm of the possibility here.
Well, the Federal Office of Inspector, the Federal OIG is investigating the establishment of the AMP, average manufacturer's price that rebates are based upon. Any pharmacy benefit manager, some states actually do this work on their own, rely on the accuracy of the information that's being provided by the pharmaceutical manufacturers. So an audit of us would not get at the accuracy of the pharmaceutical manufacturers' pricing and rebating. The audit would show which pharmaceutical manufacturers, which claims for rebates are in dispute. There's something called Medicaid rebate dispute resolution, where Merck or Pfizer would dispute the amount of money that the state of Oregon is requesting, and there's a dispute resolution process, and sometimes the pharmaceutical manufacturers don't pay those amounts because they consider them to be in dispute. But all of that rebate information is information that the state that OMAP and First Health could provide on the rebate amounts, and that is very different than a commercial PBM, which has negotiated, including the PBMs that are managing the Oregon health plans, they have negotiated rebate contracts that are made with the PBM, between the PBM and the pharmaceutical manufacturers. The rebate checks that are cut from shearing plow, made out to the name of the PBM, deposited in PBM accounts, and then that money may or may not be shared with their client, the managed care organization that is contracting with them. So that is an entirely different scenario than the Pharmacy Benefit Administration of a state program, where the rebates are between the state of Oregon and the pharmaceutical manufacturer, and the money is in fact deposited in state accounts and written to the state on a state check. So those are key fundamental differences between a commercial PBM plan, including those that manage the Medicaid MCO contracts, and First Health Services. You also heard the prior gentleman testify to these other contracts between the pharmaceutical manufacturers and commercial PBMs. That can be for any number of service-related items. But we too believe that is not a business practice that we choose to follow, and that as I mentioned earlier, First Health Services has no contracts with the pharmaceutical manufacturers themselves, either rebate or in these other service contracts. Some of the commercial PBMs actually get 40% to 50% of their revenue from the pharmaceutical manufacturers.
Well, and I think you were talking and touting free market tools and why that was an appropriate use of leverage and influence and negotiation. I think the plans, the individual plans, PBMs, I mean, I have every conviction that falls within their purview, and the free market tools for them to manage their population in the way they see best fit
and quite frankly, I think they do a very good job of it. With regard to the audit that we recommend, I think that also feels or falls into the category of free market or prudent business practices. I think there's been, and this don't in, we're not insinuating anything here, you know, but just good business prudence would say, you know, we audit people that handle that kind of money. It's not an inference. It's not an impropriety. And really, I mean, I don't mean this in a negative way. We'd hope we'd find, in a beneficial way, that there were practices that First Health could do that would improve, as we've been discussing here at length, the amount of the 40% we could get back.
Well,
that's not a judgmental statement. That's just a practical statement.
Well, again, and let's talk about how we could do that, and I'll describe the multi-state pool briefly, which could help us get there.
I did. Just I want to make sure I heard one part of you clearly, because it's something at least we should think about. You're basically saying to us, given the tools, you believe you can recover for us the supplemental rebates, which even at a discounted 40% are higher than the 6%, and that 6% you got to take, you only get 40% of that too. So you're talking about 2 or 3% inside one group and 6 or 8% inside the other group. You think you can bring the tools to bear on management that are as good as what the
absolutely. If
so
the legislature were to give OMAP the authority,
you can do this as well as the plans can, and plus get the 6 or 8% rebate to the state.
Absolutely. And the way that one way to enhance the rebates is there's been a lot of discussion around the country about multi-state pooling. And my general recommendation is that states need to look at the pooling, what pooling they can do within their own state before they look at multi-state pooling. As I mentioned earlier, this Medicaid best price rule does not apply to the managed care plans, either your state employee plans or your Medicaid MCO plans. So there are roughly 400,000 people in the Oregon Health Plan. 60% of them, I believe, are in managed care. So that's 240,000 are in managed care. 160,000 are in fee-for-service. We could easily do a preferred drug list and negotiate supplemental rebates just for the 160,000 people. But it would be better if we negotiated the supplemental rebates for all 400,000 people. That then brings us to the multi-state pooling initiative, which is exactly that. It's each state in South Carolina, Michigan, and Vermont have pooled the number of Medicaid lives in their programs, 100,000 in Vermont, 900,000 in South Carolina, and 1 million in Michigan, to create a pool of 2 million people that we are, as we speak, negotiating supplemental rebates for. The addition of 400,000 people in Oregon to that pool would create a pool of 2.4 million people. And that is the goal of the multi-state pool. It's the more lives, hopefully the greater the discount the pharmaceutical manufacturers will be willing to give. So again, it just makes the point you could add the 160, you could pool 160, or you could pool 400,000. Again, you just need to do the financial analysis on each one of these variables to determine which one will save you the most money. And so, you know, I think the point I made earlier is that if your pharmacy costs are the same and you fairly renegotiate your cap rates, that the financial analysis will probably show that your maximum savings will come from the pooling of all lives into the fee-for-service program. But you would not want to do that unless you have adequate management tools on that program. The reason the states moved drug spend 10 years ago to managed care was because those were the only programs that had the management tools in place to manage those programs. So it would be a big mistake to carve out the drug spend and bring it back to fee-for-service if you didn't have a mandatory preferred drug list with prior authorization, with supplemental rebates, with clinical detailing, with all of these other programs that
didn't even know that was a whisper of a consideration.
I agree with your statement, but I don't know where it comes from.
Well, I thought I saw in some of the proposals, some of the earlier proposals, some discussion of carving out the drug spend from the managed care plans to allow the state to try to capture the higher Medicaid rebates. I believe that was the first provision in this document.
No, I mean, that's just nice discussion, but we're not going there. I agree with you. That would be a huge mistake. That's why we're not going there. And, you know, you talk about this, Scott, and I understand what you're saying, and on paper and theory, it absolutely, you know, makes sense about you give the tools, the state the tools, and they can do the same job. I'm pretty sure I disagree with that. And the reason I say that, it kind of goes back to what old saying my dad used to use all the time. Because I don't care what business you're in, whether it's plastics or blank, it's management, management, management. And you've got a very fine manager sitting right behind you in Mr. Clark. These guys are world-class healthcare delivery system managers, and they couldn't make it right here in the Mid-Willamette Valley. A small managed care organization came in, MidVip, and they're doing just fine. And I think there's a key component in what Oregon has in our managed care organizations in these 14 regional managed care plans, and it's the personal relationships and the benefits of local knowledge, who they're dealing with. I'm not sure the state of Oregon could just step in, given exactly the same tools, and make that work. And I'm not slamming on Regents or you, David. It's a very delicate balance in how these things work and how managed care organizations work. And, you know, I'm glad Regents is here, and I'm glad that I'm insured with Regents. But in terms of the social dynamic in making these things work, I'm just not sure we give the state the same tools. And granted, I'm saying I'm not sure. And all of a sudden, we get all the benefits of these local and regional managed care organizations. I'm not sure all that bubbles to the surface.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bates.
Along those lines, I share many of the same concerns, but I'm still intrigued. Have you approached in any of your markets where you have these tools a generic market that's 75 or 80%? Have you reached that level anywhere as an agency working for the entire state?
Well, as I mentioned, the CMS does not allow fee-for-service programs to establish closed formularies. Kaiser and other, where some brand name drugs are literally not available under any circumstances, even if you feel it's medically necessary. The MCO plans can establish plans of that nature that give very heavy reliance on generic drugs, and that is a good thing. I think that the national average of in the fee-for-service environment is approximately 49% generic drug utilization. So our goal is to increase that as much as possible.
Follow up. So what I just heard you say was that even if we gave you the tools, the federal government's not going to allow you to have the kind of formulary an MCO would. And that's a tool. It's pretty important for you to get that generic level up if you want to go in that direction.
Well, there should be a mandatory generic substitution provision that requires the physicians to, I believe the state is planning to implement an enhanced process to require physicians to provide some justification when they want to provide a brand name drug rather than a generic drug. I think that is certainly one tool that the state should be implementing to help drive generic drug utilization. That's one, certainly one of the tools that the managed care plans use. But putting generic drugs in preferred status on these preferred drug in each therapy in key therapeutic classes is obviously a very important thing to do.
Mr. Chair,
quick question. And David, what level of generic usage have you guys achieved?
51%.
We are almost at about 50%, Mr. Chair.
50.
Wait. If we're going to go that far, you got to come to the mic, reintroduce yourself, say hi.
This is David Clark, and just to answer the question that I was asked by the chairman, the Regions Group currently has a total generic utilization just under 50%. I would like to ask Representative Bates if the 75% he's talking about is generic substitution or total generic utilization as a percent of total prescriptions, because there's a difference. Our generic substitution rates are in the mid-90s. Our total generic utilization as a percent of prescriptions is almost one generic for every brand. Nationally, the average is 40%, and so achieving something closer to 50 has been deemed very positive by us and by others.
Go ahead.
I will go back and find out for sure if those figures are correct. My understanding is that 75% is the actual utilization rate, whether it's gotten by the original prescription or by automatically switching to a generic, I don't know. But I can find out for you.
And that floats between 60 and 1 is actually up to 80.
Representative Bates, that's a very good question. There is a difference between those two elements.
The net result, though, is that of the prescriptions filled, we're looking at 70-75% being generic.
The key way to do that.
Asking.
The key way to do that is by requiring prior authorization. The physician has to call our clinical call center and have a discussion with our clinical pharmacist, where our clinical pharmacist is trying to convince the physician to write the generic drug. So that is one of the key means of converting a brand name drug to a generic drug, is to convince the patient's physician by requiring a prior authorization call to change the prescription. So that's what the managed care plans do, because they have the authority to use prior authorization.
And my original question to you was, in reality, have you been able to achieve that? If you had any place, you've got the tools to do that. And if you do, have you ever achieved anything above 50%? That's the only thing. I'm just questioning.
Well, I believe Mr. Clark just said that his generic utilization rate was about 50%. Michigan's was 51%. I do not know the actual conversion rate of prescriptions that come in for a multi-source brand that are then converted to a generic drug through the interaction of this prior authorization process. That's a harder number to establish.
Mr. Chair, just to make sure we are on the same page here, all I care about is which drugs end up being dispensed as generic versus brand name. And if I'm understanding you, it's 51% in Michigan.
I believe the Medicaid fee-for-service programs, because they around the country have stronger mandatory generic substitution laws, generally have slightly higher generic drug utilization than non-Medicaid programs. It's a couple percentage points difference, I believe.
Thank you.
Of all days, I mean, normally we've got pharmaceutical people in here, but we've got plan people all over this room would be.
Where's Mitch?
Yeah, where's Greenlick when we need him?
We need the guy, you know.
Tom, do you know off the top of your head the answer to David's question? I mean, is this substitution or is this total utilization?
I
think it's total utilization.
Yes. Good point.
And you guys are both talking about total psychotropic 7-Eleven drugs,
right?
Yeah, that's another key point we didn't ask.
That is.
Just for the record, that was Tom Holt mumbling in the background, and he indicated that some of the carved out drugs, cancer, AIDS, 7-Eleven drugs would bring the total percentage down, the total utilization down.
Scott, could you explain a little bit how Michigan handles its mental health? Here we carve out our mental health drugs.
Yes.
What Michigan does with theirs is
a good question. The mental health drug categories tend to be some of the most costly in any Medicaid program. The state of Michigan decided to include the mental health drug categories in the development of the preferred drug list. However, they did make exceptions for patients that were stabilized on some of the of drugs. If a drug became non-preferred, but the patient was stabilized on that non-preferred drug, they were grandfathered under the system such that they did not have to seek prior authorization to continue on those therapies. But new patients, newly diagnosed patients, and physicians are expected to write off of the preferred drug list for mental health patients. And that is clearly a significant area of savings when a state carves those mental health categories out and does not include it in the preferred drug list. It reduces your overall savings proportionally, and the cost savings I gave you earlier did include the inclusion of mental health drugs in the state's preferred drug list. Just one final note on the.
I'm really enjoying this.
Thank you
for coming.
It may not be, but we.
I mean,
the multi-state pooling program. Just to summarize again, the pharmaceutical manufacturers were asked to bid on each therapeutic class, so that the participating states. Do not, by definition, do not need to select the same preferred drugs. They do not have to use the same preferred drug list. Each state maintains their individual clinical review process. And most states, it's a pharmacy and therapeutics committee. The pharmacy and therapeutics committee in some states considers the cost information. Some states it does not. It is ultimately, under this model, the state has the final decision-making authority over what drugs to include in its preferred drug list. Considering price as one of several factors in the final decision-making process. So again, even if we're simply talking about ways to improve your fee-for-service program, your $250 million fee-for-service program, the establishment and negotiation of supplemental rebates is a potential tool to reduce the overall cost of the drugs in those in the fee-for-service plan.
Mr. Pacoli.
Thank you. There's been a lot of litigation around the country on different drug programs, and I keep thinking that Michigan and Florida might have been involved in some of that.
Yes.
Were they? Are they still? Is any of this subject to perhaps?
There are four major lawsuits. Pharma sued the state of Florida and Governor Bush's administration to prevent the implementation of a preferred drug list model there. Under that particular model, the state legislature passed a bill that said that manufacturers had to contribute an additional 10% rebate or they would not be considered at all for the preferred drug list. So under that model, price was established right at the outset before any of the decisions were made about the final preferred drug list. Those that refused to bid were not considered at all. Florida was sued. To date, they have won all of their litigation, and I believe that the most recent decision there is at the U.S. Court of Appeals for that particular district, again, upholding the right of states to implement prior authorization-based programs, and that supplemental rebates were, in fact, legal under the Social Security Act. Pharma also sued the state of Michigan and Governor Engler. When his administration tried to implement a similar program, that suit was tried in state courts based on the assumption that the state of Michigan did not have adequate statutory authority. In that particular instance, the authority was done through budget language rather than a state statute. To date, Michigan has won all of that litigation. The most important case, however, was the recent lawsuit by Pharma against Tommy Thompson and HHS that sought to prevent CMS from approving any more state plan amendments, any other state requests to develop prior authorization-based preferred drug lists and supplemental rebate programs. The goal was to prevent CMS from approving any more states' efforts, and that litigation was resolved about 2 weeks ago, from today, I believe. And Judge Bates ruled very clearly that all of the pharmaceutical industry's arguments were essentially without merit. So the summary of that decision is in your packet. There's also a U.S. Supreme Court case with the state of Maine that is still pending, and that goes to the issue of what people are entitled to these Medicaid rebates. And one thing you might want to consider as you're trying to decide whether or not you can afford to maintain a pharmacy benefit for the 100,000 people that are, I believe, at risk of losing their coverage here in Oregon, is that you might want to consider establishing a Medicaid discount program for those people, where you, if the state were to pay a 20% share of the cost of their drugs, that would entitle you to obtain the Medicaid rebates from the pharmaceutical manufacturers, which is another 20%. The consumer would then be able to purchase drugs at the Medicaid price, which is a little lower than retail. So those 100,000 people could be given a Medicaid discount program benefit. It's not fully funded. It's not 100% paid by the state and federal government, but a 50% discount off of retail is a fairly sizable discount. And what some states are thinking of doing is to take some of the rebate money from the pharmaceutical manufacturers, collect it, and then redistribute some of it to the pharmacists to compensate them for the loss of the cash paying customer that they've just lost, as you've converted them from a retail cash paying customer that's paying AWP plus 15% into an AWP minus 15% customer. So that is a creative way that the state of Oregon might be able to continue to provide a benefit for some of these folks that would otherwise lose all of their drug coverage. And again, you could then pool those lives into a comprehensive Medicaid supplemental rebate negotiation process to maximize your rebates even further. It's a little complicated, but I could provide some background information on how that can be done.
Well, win, lose, or draw, I don't know about the global strategic thinking when you go ahead and sue the president's brother, but that's a whole different story. Any other questions for Scott? This has been very helpful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming the great distance you came, and thank David and Patty. It's been an excellent panel today. I want to clarify one statement I made. It wasn't that regions couldn't make it here. They chose to provide better customer service in other areas of the state. So,
well, thank you very much for inviting me out. And if you have any other questions for me, don't hesitate to ask.
Scott will be in touch. Anyway, great panel today. Thank you very much. Seeing no other further business to come before the committee, we are adjourned.